Pseudopod, episode 107, September 12th, 2008. This week's story, Front Row Seats by Scott William Carter. Hi, welcome to Pseudopod, the weekly horror podcast. I'm your host, Alistair, and this week's story comes to us from Scott William Carter, whose first novel, The Last Great Getaway of the Water Balloon Boys, is due for release in 2010 from Simon & Schuster. This is Scott's first appearance with us. Your narrator this week is Rick Stringer of Variant Frequencies. So make sure you get a good seat, and remember, what's showing, in the end, isn't what actually matters. Because I have a story for you, and I promise you, it's true.
Front Row Seats by Scott William Carter. Daniel lingered in his cramped office at the University of Minnesota, long after the other professionals in the math department called it a day. He was still there when all the lights under the doors winked out, and the parking lot outside his window was a bleak, snow-draped emptiness. He was at his desk when old Cal Thomas from geography shuffled past, taking his incessant coughing with him. He stayed until the equations on shifted lattices turned to squirrely nonsense, lines and squiggles on ruled pages. Until finally, he felt the thing creep into his thoughts, that black starfish wrapping its prickly limbs around whatever memories he chose to dwell upon, making his ears ring and his eyes water. When he felt it coming, he finally got up, knowing that it didn't matter where he was, because the pain would be the same. He took the rear stairwell in the off chance someone was in the lobby. When he hit the frosty outside air, he realized he had left his overcoat, but he didn't want to go back, so he trudged, shivering, to his Camry. A kid with a stocking cap dotted with ice rode past on a 10-speed, tires crunching over packed snow. Daniel waited for the look of pity he was used to seeing, but the kid did not look his way. On his commute home to New Ulm, Daniel passed near the Cinema 3 Theater, and he thought, what the hell? As long as the theater was crowded, maybe no one would know he was there by himself. What's your most popular movie? He asked the kid at the window, a round-faced boy who wore a button that read, Escape with Us.
The most full, sir?
The kid said, voice crackling through the intercom. Yeah. Which one is that? His teeth chattered in the frigid air.
Harry Potter starts in 5 minutes. We got 7 seats left for that.
Is that any good? Forget it. That'll be fine.
One adult, sir?
No, he said, then caught himself. The starfish fluttered at the edge of his vision, and he felt as though his lungs collapsed as he forced out the rest. Yes. One, please. The kid slid the ticket through the opening in the glass. When Daniel took it, he felt the stream of hot air blowing out of the little coffin of a room.
Hey, aren't you Professor Cooper?
Daniel cringed. Of course he should have expected this. Of course he might be recognized. He knew what the kid was thinking. Poor wretch, going to the movies by himself. He nodded.
I had calculus with you last year. I'm sorry about your wife, man.
Daniel said some trifle that seemed appropriate, but which he immediately forgot once he walked through the doors. He had many rehearsed responses. Thanks. I appreciate your condolences. Thanks. I'm doing okay. Thanks. I'm seeing someone now, and it's helping. He seldom thought consciously about them. The packed theater smelled of warm bodies and popcorn. He stumbled across a few people in the second to last row and found a seat in the middle. As he sat, the lights dimmed. He was grateful. In the anonymity of the darkness, he could pretend it wasn't an old woman next to him who smelled of peppermint. If he kept his eyes facing forward and repressed the urge to turn, he could pretend it was Deborah. And it was just some new perfume she was trying, some sample she had gotten free in the mail. Deborah loved movies. There were many nights he was busy, first with homework, later his thesis, and now student papers and research, when she had gone to the movies. Unlike him, she didn't seem to mind going alone. She was not a discriminating critic. She loved Sleepless in Seattle as much as she loved Edward Scissorhands. She said Star Trek V was fantastic, even though the critics trashed it. She laughed for days after seeing Dumb and Dumber, mimicking Jim Carrey's obnoxious facial expressions, until I asked her to quit. While the theater's opening bit played, a cartoon mouse who warned to turn cell phones and pagers off, a kid behind Daniel kicked on the back of Daniel's seat. He was going to turn and say something when the film stopped and the room went dark. Completely dark. As dark as the windowless cellar in his house, where he would go when the starfish was squeezing too hard. The darkness was brief, not even long enough for the stunned silence to turn to hissing at the control booth. Just a room full of silent bodies, air trapped in lungs. And then the film was playing again. And there, in the uneven light, Daniel saw the old man for the first time. He had come in during the darkness. A coincidence, Daniel thought at first. A frail fellow with stooped shoulders. The only hair he had, a few tufts of white with a yellowish tint, stood on end. His shoelaces snapped against his loafers as he shuffled down the aisle. He watched as this fellow took one of three remaining front row seats, easing himself down. Hands pressed hard against the armrests like a gymnast straining against the parallel bars. In the back of his head was just another dark outline laced with light, and he was part of the audience as the movie rolled. Daniel turned his attention to the film. His escape lasted for perhaps 20 minutes before his thoughts returned to Deborah. He was trying to remember the last movie they saw together, and as he plumbed his memories, he felt the thing stirring at the edge of his mind. He forced his attention on the movie, and felt the thing loosen its grip. The onslaught of images seemed to be keeping the thing at bay. It would have continued if it hadn't been for the old man. The movie was at one of its tensest moments, Harry and his friends creeping through the castle. The audience was silent. The only sounds, a few people scraping the bottom of their popcorn barrels, whispers, creaking chairs, and something else. Something that didn't belong. Laughter. It was coming from the old man. He couldn't see the old man's face, but saw that the old man had his hands over his mouth, his shoulders shaking. The kids on both sides of him stared. A man in a cowboy hat cleared his throat. A woman a few rows back made a shh sound. A lot of people laughed when nervous, but this wasn't that kind of laugh. This was a genuine belly laugh, a good-natured laugh, a laugh that wasn't right at all for the scene. Daniel tried to get his mind back into the movie, but he couldn't wrestle his attention away from the old man. He watched him closely for the rest of the film and saw how he reacted strangely at other times, too. He jerked back when nothing had happened. He laughed into his arm when Harry's friend was clobbered. His body sagged in boredom during the most riveting action sequence of the movie. Senility? Dementia? It could have been anything. And Daniel would have dismissed the old man and his odd behavior if it hadn't been for the affinity he felt for him, because of the loneliness he imagined they shared. So when the credits rolled and the lights came up, Daniel continued to watch him. They filed into the aisle, Daniel ahead. But in the lobby, Daniel waited on the far wall. He glanced at his watch nonchalantly as the rest of the audience poured out, until it became a trickle, and then no one at all. when two boys with brooms, dustbins, and trash bags headed inside. The old man still hadn't shown. When he went inside, he found only the two kids, whose snickering fell silent when he entered. Daniel mumbled that he lost his wallet and walked to the first row, glancing down all the aisles. He crouched where the old man had been sitting, saw nothing unusual, then pulled out his wallet and said loudly, "Ah, found it!" He went to another movie the next night, a Tom Cruise flick, whose title he forgot once inside, and found what he had experienced the previous night happened again. The more riveted his attention to the film, the more the starfish retreated, and the more his depression was forgotten in his suspension of disbelief. From then on, he was hooked. He went to a film every night, and then it was two a night, and then it was canceling his classes to see matinees during the day. Some men drowned their grief in alcohol and narcotics. Daniel suffocated his own sorrow in celluloid. He still felt embarrassed at being alone. But when he wasn't in the theater, he was irritable. He snapped at colleagues. He frequently trailed off in front of students, hand poised on the chalkboard in mid-equation, his train of thought lost as he mused about what movie he would see that night. He was at his third showing of The Lord of the Rings when he saw the old man again. As before, the film seized up during the trailers, and when it started, there was the old man, shuffling down the aisle. And once again during the film, his reactions were all wrong. Daniel decided to follow him. When the lights went up, he stayed seated. He pretended to fiddle with his watch until the old man in a thicket of people moved past. Daniel folded into the crowd, keeping his attention riveted on the old man's wrinkled neck. Until that moment, it was all for curiosity's sake. But then, the man's head turned to the side, and Daniel got a good look at his face. There was a starfish. The dusky shadow of a five-armed starfish gripped the old man's face like the fingers of an outstretched glove. The starfish flashed quickly and disappeared, but it was there long enough that Daniel knew it was not a play of light. It was the same thing he saw when he looked in the mirror long enough, when the pain was bad, and if he let his eyes go askance. He jostled forward. A woman he bumped made a noise of disgust. A kid yelled, "Hey!" He saw the old man's overcoat appear. He reached for it and felt his fingers brush up against the coarse fabric. And then the crowd collapsed inward and his fingers touched empty air. When the crowd parted again, the old man was gone. This time he made no attempt to hide his desperation. He bobbed on his tiptoes, searching for the bald head. He bumped and banged his way to the front of the crowd. When he didn't find him, he turned and headed back into the crowd, like a fish swimming upstream. He searched all the rows, scanned the lobby, and looked under the stall doors in the restrooms. He bolted outside where falling snow looked bloodstained in the light of the setting sun. Now Daniel had another reason to go to the movies, and it overrode all other reasons he had to do anything else. He took a leave of absence from the university, leaving in the middle of winter term, not caring that he disgusted his dean. For the next month, he went to art house flicks, big budget blockbusters, the Dollar Theater, even the community college Tuesday silent movie night, where they were making their way through Charlie Chaplin. He never stayed for long, only long enough to see that the old man wasn't there. Finally, his complexion as pale as ivory, his eyes stinging every time he walked in the sun, the starfish biting down on his skull the way a wolf's jaw closes on a squirming rabbit, Daniel saw the old man again. It was a Sunday matinee, a new Disney animation. Thinking that the old man wasn't coming, Daniel rose and was heading up the aisle when the film stopped and clutched the room in darkness. When it started again, There was the old man, coming straight at him. He had his head down. He started to weave around Daniel, then glanced up, locked eyes, and pulled up short. The starfish fluttered across Daniel's vision, and he saw that the starfish appeared on the old man's face as well. The old man's eyes widened.
No! No, no! Not yet! Not now!
He turned and headed back up the aisle. Daniel quickly caught up to him, grabbing him by the arm of his rumpled plaid shirt. It was no wider around than a broomstick.
You know what this is, don't you?
The old man's mouth opened and closed.
Don't you?
Yes.
You can help me?
Yes.
The old man bowed his head.
I just wanted more time.
The old man looked at Daniel, his face full of deep shadows. Behind them, gunfire and shouting blared from the speakers. A trailer for a new Western.
Come with me.
Daniel followed him into the lobby. They didn't speak, but pushed through the double glass doors out into the night. The back pocket of the old man's plaid wrinkled slacks turned inside out so that it looked like the tip of a handkerchief. Daniel felt the frosty air lap up against his skin. They walked a block, still not looking at one another, like two pallbearers holding a heavy burden between them. The old man angled into a bar, and Daniel followed. It was a deserted, smoky place. Tiny piano music piped in through speakers too small for the room. They settled into a booth at the back. The tabletop, a decoupage of newspapers from the 50s. In the middle of the table was a candle in red opaque glass.
My name is Ned Brindle.
Daniel said his own name. Ned Brindle nodded and looked down at the melting wax. When he opened his mouth to speak, a waitress in a black apron was there at the table, a pad in her hand, but he didn't look at her.
I am nothing much. A plain and simple man who has suffered, just as you. This thing that haunts us. I don't know much about it, only what I was told and what I will tell you. It seeks out those who suffer and feeds on that suffering. It stays with a person for a time until he can suffer no more. And then it moves on to someone else. That's what's happening. It's moving. It's moving from me to you. But it doesn't only take. It also gives.
The waitress mumbled something about coming back later and retreated to the front of the bar. Neither Daniel or the old man looked at her.
What was her name?
Daniel knew the old man wasn't talking about the waitress. But his pain leaped out and seized him, made him cautious.
Who? Don't be coy. You know who.
No, really,
Tell me. Tell me, or I'll get up right now and take all the hope you have.
Deborah. Her name was Deborah. She was my wife.
And you loved her?
Daniel nodded.
Tell me about her.
So Daniel did. Though he had refused to talk about her these past 6 months with anyone, he told Ned how she sang off key in the shower when she would never sing in front of anyone, how she thought he couldn't hear because he had already gone to work. But once in a while, he would come back in the bedroom and stand by the bathroom door, breathing quietly, listening to her voice. She usually sung nursery rhymes. We were waiting. I was waiting until things settled down. There was the doctorate and then tenure. And then we are going to buy a house. I always thought, who gets breast cancer at 29?
Ed listened until Daniel finished, then ordered two glasses of red wine.
My wife's name was Alice. I was a pilot and overtime paid well. Alice, she was a painter, taught children at the local community center. I think she liked the teaching more than the painting itself. Once, when I happened to get home a day early, I went to surprise her at the community center. Before going in, I stood outside and watched through the window, watched her helping those children, the utter joy in her face. I seldom saw that face. It belonged to the children, that face, not to me.
The wine came. They drank. They listened to the music and leaned back in their booths. You said it also gives, Daniel said, feeling the light headiness that came from drinking on an empty stomach. He nodded.
Your wife. She liked going to the movies, didn't she?
That's right. How?
I know, because it seeks out people who lost someone who loved the movies. Why? I don't know. Maybe it's the escape. It feeds on the rush the grieving get from an escape. Alice loved the movies. Bambi. Rambo. It made little difference. Since I was often gone, she went without me. But we did go a few times, and those are the ones I remember. Those are the ones I see. I see movies that no one else sees. The movies the thing allows me to see, because it wants me to see them. I have spent the last 5 years in the theater of my mind. I have stepped from one theater to another as if nothing else exists.
Ned put his clenched fist on the table. Slowly, he opened his fingers. And a tiny purple rectangle wafted to the table.
Pick it up.
Daniel did. It was a ticket stub, so worn and wrinkled it felt like cotton. The text had faded so that it was unreadable.
I don't know if it is part of the thing that haunts us, or if it came later. But it has kept the pain at bay, and it has allowed me these few years of indulgence. Now, I offer it to you, just as it was offered to me. Not because I want to, but because when I saw the thing on your face, I knew it was time.
Daniel looked at the ticket. It didn't look like anything special, hardly more than a piece of lint pulled out of the dryer. This allows you to watch these other movies. Movies that aren't the ones playing?
I never said I was watching them.
He guzzled the rest of his wine, stood and snatched the ticket out of Daniel's fingers.
I can't explain this gift to you. You have to accept it on faith.
Ned dropped a 20 on the table and shuffled out the front door. Daniel hesitated, then decided that if it could make the pain stop, even for a little while, he had to try. He found Ned, waiting for him outside under the awning. It was snowing.
You want it, then?
Yes. Ned winced, as if he had been pricked with a needle. Then extended his hand, not to shake it, but as if to lead him.
Take it?
What?
Take my hand.
Why?
Don't worry about your manhood. It's the only way we can do this.
Daniel glanced around uncomfortably, hating for people to see them. Two men, one older, both lost and pathetic, standing hand in hand in the cold. The snowflakes, big as cotton balls, stuck to the old man's bald head the way they might stick to a statue. Daniel took the old man's hand. Ned turned, took a step, and when their feet came down, they did so on soft carpet with a slight downward grade. The room was dark. He heard people breathing, chairs squeaking, a baby crying. The film kicked on, and Ned released his hand. They sat in the front row, empty chairs on both sides. Ned sat still until a few trailers had played, and then said in a whisper,
"Open your hand."
Daniel placed his hand on the armrest, fingers open as if to catch a ball. He felt the worn ticket tickle his palm, and he closed his hand around it.
"I pass it on to you. When you get what you need, you must pass it on to the next person. You will know them when you see them. You will know them when you are ready to go back to your life."
He stood. Daniel looked up at him and saw the starfish appear on the old man's face, then break apart and dissolve.
"Goodbye."
Ned turned swiftly and headed up the aisle. This time he did not vanish, but simply walked through the door and was gone. Daniel turned back to the screen. Jodie Foster was an FBI agent. Oh, why did it have to be Silence of the Lambs? He hated this movie. He never liked the scary ones. But yes, it had been one of the first he had seen with Deborah. She never minded being scared. At least, when it was only a movie. It was then that he felt warm and nimble fingers close in around his free hand. There had been no one sitting in the seat next to him. Of this he was absolutely sure. But the tension in his fingers, the long nails biting into his hand, the lip of the ring chafing his index finger, these sensations were known to him. He knew who it was. And he was afraid that if he turned and looked, the feeling would go away. Now, he understood what the old man meant. "I never said I was watching them." He settled into his chair, feeling the pressure on his hand increase. If he strained, he could just make out her shallow breathing, a gasp. He was still afraid to look, but there were many more movies. They had been quite a few over the years, and he would see them all again. During one, he might risk a glance. And then he knew. Knew that the old man's parting word of farewell had not been meant for Daniel at all.
I'm a cinema child. I can remember the first film I went to see, Return of the Jedi, the first time a film made me cry, Always, which is the Steven Spielberg remake of A Guy Called Joe, and he's great, by the way, the first film I really, truly despised, Arlington Road, which isn't, and the last film I saw, Fargo, about 24 hours ago. Where my father loves books, I love cinema, and it's impossible for me not to think in terms that don't include it. It's my language, it's my grammar. This story perfectly illustrates why. Film takes you somewhere else, somewhere more complex than simply the world the film creates. If you've seen it before, it connects you to those moments, those times, and if you haven't, it shows you a world where the best and worst of humanity is expanded and exploded for all to see. The Vitruvian Man stretched out across a screen two stories tall, or, if you're really lucky, on IMAX. Done right, film, hell, any form of art, grabs you that way, instantly and completely, and refuses to let you go. It shows you people to aspire to be, people to avoid being at all costs, opens a window to a different world and invites you in. It's an escape, a door into the past or the future, and sometimes, That's all you need to get to the end of the day. Although we need a couple more things to get to the end of this episode. See what I did there? The first is to make the point that we rely on you to pay our authors, so if you liked this story, please do us and them an immense favour. Go to pseudopod.org and click on Feed the Pod. I promise you, you won't regret it. Secondly, there's the small but important point that, say it with me everybody, Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives license. And Pseudopod would like you to go and visit one of our clients in Transylvania, a certain Count Dracula.